Welcome back to episode 16 of the Amateur Theatre Podcast, and the first in our series of script clubs, kicking off with James Fritz's 4 minutes and 12 seconds. To offer up a brief synopsis of the play for those who have not had a chance to read it, it follows the fallout of an incident that occurs outside of a school where a young man named Jack is accosted and returns home to his mother and father bloodied from the incident. We then follow how this incident reverberates through the family and the responses of those closest to Jack. It tackles issues of how modern technology infiltrates the lives of those who interact with it, the moral response to a crime that's perpetrated, and how a mother deals with her son as he transitions from being a child into becoming an adult and starts making his own moral judgments and decisions about what's right and wrong. It's intense, it's funny, it's very compelling, and it offers a wide variety of topics to digest and discuss, which we seek to do. And I've invited a couple of friends of mine who have an interest in theatre and the dramatic arts. You'll recognise, hopefully, the voice of Kelly Stewart, who was one of my early podcast guests, but also Cheryl Birdseye, or Dr. Cheryl Birdseye, to give her official title, who has been my assistant director, dramaturg, assistant producer on pretty much all my plays over the last 6 to 10 years, and also Matthew Bevington, who has had an interest in various forms of theatre since I've known him. He has acted in a number of my plays, and we've spent many an hour watching and discussing plays together, and also many more hours attempting to write a play together. So all of them have a unique and interesting perspective on the formulation of a play, what they like and what they don't like, and bring to the table an interesting set of views that I believe play off quite well with each other. If you've not had a chance to read the play, hopefully we've discussed it in a manner that is interesting in and of itself, but do feel free to press the stop button, grab the play, have a read, and then come back and join us. Also, in preparation for next month's script club, you might want to head out and find a copy of Sadie by David Island. So grab a copy of that, have a read, and prepare yourselves to get involved in the conversation next month. Until then, sit back and enjoy. My first question straight away is to you, Kelly.
Mm.
Given that you were the one who brought it up in a previous podcast, did you like it?
Yeah, I do like it. I do like it. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's, you know, I mean, I saw it when it was like just come out and I was 18 when I went to see it. So I think maybe that was partly why also it spoke to me quite a bit, because I was sort of the same age that I think Cara and Jack are supposed to be. And I still really like it. I still think it's a really good play. But I think there are definitely things that, like Matt said, like in places where, you know, you can kind of question it, as, you know, how realistic is that? How much of it is for, you know, plot? What is, you know, yeah. But I think, yeah, I think it's a really good play. And I think one of the reasons I like it is I think it's one of the few pieces of theatre where they try and tackle class and it's not this sort of washed through thing that like really simplifies it. And the fact that actually class dynamics are extremely complicated and the culture and assumptions around them are much more ingrained than I think we ever really realise. And I think that's something that really speaks in the play, and that's something that I really like about it.
Okay. Cheryl?
Yeah, no, I liked it as well. I think, again, like, I'm at least in a way that I went in completely blind with the play, although I put it down and I was like, crikey, what's Mike started us off with? That was like some heavy material, my God. I think considering what a heavy subject it is, I feel like that the play handled it very well. Like, I get very annoyed with not just plays, but like a lot of media that will use kind of issues around like consent or sexual violence as literally a plot device. So it just happens and it moves on, and it's used as shorthand for something like, oh, this is a bad guy, or this is why this is a neurotic woman. You know, like it's there at the start just as kind of like scene dressing, and then it's just completely forgotten about. So the fact that, you know, they've taken a really complicated and really distressing like piece of material and made in my mind anyway quite convincing play about it. It's certainly not perfect, but the unsatisfactory ending and the way that some of the characters respond, the journeys that, you know, certainly that Di goes on, it felt convincing and not like it was just sort of taking a topical subject and, you know, kind of whizzing something out. So yeah, I liked it.
Okay, cool. Matt?
So I think I admire it as a piece of writing and as a piece of theatre, and I find it quite entertaining and interesting. Would I voluntarily go back to it? I'm not sure. I think I'd want to see I want to see plays about some of the other things this is about, really, that maybe dig into some of the other stuff.
Yeah.
Like, where do you get to in the end? You get that sort of unsatisfied, unhappy feeling that maybe evokes real life, but I don't know whether we get that far on some of the bigger debates that it tries to tap into. So my abiding feeling is that it makes me want to see more plays about some of the similar issues.
I thought it was like a really interesting depiction of class and class struggles, particularly when trying to sort of that sort of like weird middle ground of sort of a bit, maybe it's also from my own personal experience as well, of like parents who were sort of working class growing up, and then have managed to sort of, I guess, situate themselves in a better position or whatever later on in life. And now, and they're obviously quite obsessed about like giving their children like what they didn't get to have. And I think within that, you see very early on like a lot of prejudices that, for example, like Di has. But then you can see over the course of the play that very much that she and David came from the exact same background once. And I think it's got some really interesting, I think, like social commentary within that. And also, of course, where Jack ends up. And there's a bit like the very opening line is like, oh, you know, because they think he's posh. And she's like, well, Jack's not posh because we're not posh. And he's like, well, he wears a blazer and he goes to that school kind of thing. And like to them, it's like, oh, because we worked really hard to get him to that school because we didn't get to go to a school like that. And it's kind of all that kind of like, I guess, like rhetoric or like discourse is like, I think, really fundamental to the play. And then obviously within that, you then have obviously like a much bigger like themes around consent and online, you know, the ability to, for, you know, sort of revenge porn and all that kind of stuff, I think that comes within the storyline, which I think is also really powerful. But I think, yeah, I think a big part of what holds the play together is that sort of class dynamic. And I think that's something that I found really interesting, because I don't think James Fritz in any way makes it simple or easy or nice in any way. Like, it doesn't have a satisfying ending.
Did you find reading it was either trying to get the words off the page was not presenting the same dynamic or impact that it did on stage, and or did you find anything else about it kind of by reading the text?
I think the writer was trying to do something about technology. I think that was the whole point, because there are a few lines that are kind of, you know, kids these days, they post everything online. And I think some of the staging when I saw it was trying to bring that out more. Whereas I think, again, like I still stand by what I took away afterwards, regardless, and from reading it, which was that sort of like class dynamic perspective. But yeah, and the sort of parent thing, I think that's like a really strong feeling that you get from it, because I think it just so revolves around the mother's relationship with the son and her not being able to handle that her son's not the person she thought he was, or that she thought she was going to raise him to be. And I think there's something really human in that. Like, I think there's something that you're like, Jesus Christ, like, I don't know how anyone would deal with that. Like the possible thought that I mean, how in terms of spoiler alert, like, that basically how she's trying to come to terms with the fact that her son's most likely probably raped his girlfriend. And the thing is, that's a real thing in real life. And I think, like, yeah, I think that's the big crux of the play is that reconciling of that character, yeah. Trying to reconcile that. So yeah, reading it, I think overall, I still kind of got a lot of those things, but I think what is quite nice is because it's so stripped down to the dialogue, I think within that you can kind of imagine anything you like.
Okay, Cheryl, what was your kind of first response to it, reading it?
I very deliberately didn't read like a synopsis or anything beforehand. I tend to read a synopsis before I read a play, I find it a useful thing, but I deliberately didn't do it this time. And I'm quite glad I didn't, because like Kelly kind of mentioned already, like the fact that the play kind of, it reels you in because there's kind of revelation after revelation, which adds to the, the uncomfortableness and kind of the horror of what's happening, and also builds, because I'd agree with you, Kelly, that kind of like Di is like, in my mind, is kind of the lead for the play. She's the one that you're kind of following through. And so the play kind of develops, you're kind of moving along with her, I think, trying to work out whose narrative you should be kind of relying on, whether there are multiple people who think they're telling the truth or whether they are all actively lying. And I didn't particularly like Di like straight off, like, because I think the play is kind of designed to make you feel like, to make you not kind of particularly sympathetic towards her in the first few kind of pages, but then as you know more and more is revealed, you're like, oh wow, this is this is horrible. And she's got obviously that kind of that horrible process to go through, where she recognized that her son is not who she thought that he was, but also then when she realizes that neither is her husband, that David actually is also like that there's just an awful lot of stuff going on with David. Like, he's not only does he not perhaps recognize the severity of what's happened and what Jack's done, but also he's responsible for everything unraveling, and he can't quite understand why it's why it's such a big deal to her and indeed to Kara and Kara's family. He's just kind of very concerned about Jack's future. I thought that was the thing that really stuck out for me in the play. It was kind of the structure of it and how well it kind of set up your expectations at the start and then completely just dismantled them by the end, but all the while kind of keeping it. I thought kind of like what the plot of the play and what happened was actually very realistic, and certainly like the end, which is like a really unsatisfactory ending, was also really the only way the play could have ended if it was going to be true to life as well. Like, just this kind of sad reflection at the end that, oh yeah, he's fine. he's gone off, and of course it's been successful, and no one's talking about Kara anymore. So I think the play was surprising in the process of reading it, but realistic and not surprising in terms of like content and its kind of depiction of life, if that makes sense.
Okay, cool. And so I'm going to put a flag in the conversation about the ending, just the statement you made that it was maybe the only way it could really end to make it realistic. I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe I want to challenge that as a statement, but we can come back to that. Matthew, what are your kind of like top level thoughts on it?
Yeah. So all the class stuff that you talked about, I completely agree with. That was the thing that struck me most. As someone who has a bit of a chip on his shoulder, that I'm always kind of sensitive to that stuff anyway. So, yeah, I saw that sort of straight away. I guess there's a couple of features I found really interesting. The first being the fact that the play is in essence about someone who is never actually in the play, which is Jack. So in terms of like trusting the narrative and who do we trust, we don't actually hear from one of the two main people who probably has something to say about it. It might not change the outcome, but it's kind of interesting that you never see him or hear him, and everything you know about him, you've been told by someone else. So I'm sure everyone reading the play sort of forms an idea about Jack himself, despite having never heard anything about him. So I think that's kind of a play on the audience to get them to start forming judgments themselves without actually knowing the people that they're forming judgments about. I wonder if that's what that sort of feature is about. The second thing was to do with the dad. If, like, reading it or watching it the first time, you are in the same position as Di in the sense that all of this stuff is gradually revealed to you and you realize things sort of at the same speed. But reading it the second time, the dad takes on a completely different, like, character, because you know that the whole thing is being spun to kind of initially kind of save his skin, and then gradually, you know, so he's playing, the whole thing is basically he's pulling the strings, but you don't realize that on first kind of viewing or reading. So that's another kind of really interesting feature. I don't have anything profound to say about that, other than that I thought it was a very clever thing to do, and means that you can come back to the play a second time. Maybe, like Kelly, reading it, you actually got extra things out of it. But I think that's a good sign of a writer, that you can keep coming back to it and it takes on a different character the second time. On kind of Di's journey, I mean, she does go on a hell of a journey from being like, basically, my son is an angel, to I'm going to tell the police. And like, that is a hell of, I do wonder what that would look like visually, how you actually get there, because it does seem like one end of the spectrum to the other. So, yeah. And also, I think there are other questions, like, do we actually know that the dad published this video on that forum, or is he also trying to protect the son by taking the blame for it? And maybe that's more obvious when you sort of see it. Yeah, so I think the narrative is maybe not as neat as it appears once you've read it once or seen it once, because, you know, people's reliability is very varied and you don't hear from one of the main people. So I think there's more to explore in terms of what actually happened. And obviously the play is probably about us never knowing actually in detail what happened, but then still forming judgments, because that's what human beings do. And we still decide whose side we're on and whose side we're not on, and who are bad people and who are good people. And that's kind of where this all starts, isn't it? It's with this Di and David thinking, you know, well, we're good people and we don't do that kind of thing, but those people definitely do. So they must be to blame. So I think it's a very, very good play in the sense that it puts the audience in that position of actually making the same mistakes themselves.
Okay. That Jack thing, that he was never there, right? What? The whole, in my mind, that stuff about phones and the, you know, the invasion of the phone in your life and having it on your, why didn't his mum phone him? Why was it like, why was there no, it seemed, I just felt like a couple of text messages, just give me a bit more information, you know, it was all about that. So I was a bit lost as to why the key thread that kind of the driving force behind it that we just discussed, she didn't utilize that as a resource to get more information. She was kind of like, I know she was hiding away from it and maybe not interacting with him until she had more information or something. I know, but.
Yeah, I think the idea is her not wanting to almost speak to her son is like kind of a big part of her dealing with the doubt. Almost like she can't face him until she can be absolutely certain that it wasn't him, or maybe even the opposite. I think that's kind of implied. I think that was what I got from it anyway. It was like, she can't just like ring him or text him because she doesn't trust him. And I think that's like the key like flip that happens when, yeah, you stop having scenes where she goes off stage and you get the sense that she's spoken to him and whatever. Like, it's very that was kind of what I thought anyway from it.
Okay.
I kind of agree, like, even if you think someone's lying, you might test them and think, you know, I'll ask them something that I know the answer to and see whether they tell me it, and then I'll know whether they're lying or not, and I can trust them on other stuff. But she doesn't really seem to. I mean, is there any sense when you watch it that this stuff is happening off stage in other parts of their life? Maybe that's it.
But yeah, I think a big part of it is you don't know who to trust. Like, you don't really know what's real. Like, everyone's got their own version. And I think the fact, for me, like, one of the things I love about the play is that Jack's not in it, because I think if you see Jack, that will influence you too much one way as to what is true and what isn't, quite possibly, depending on your own sort of assumptions and how the actor played it and all that kind of stuff. And I think actually the fact that you never do is like really important, because his entire character is built up around each individual's account of him.
I think as well, like, he's not, so he's a silent character, but he's not completely like invisible. So like, although we don't see him on stage, like, we see text messages from him. Well, we don't see, but we see people showing text messages from him. We see Di's response. She reads emails from him. She reads his Facebook posts. So although he, I guess, doesn't get the opportunity to actually appear on stage for the audience to receive him visually and hear his words directly. So we are kind of obviously still relying on kind of an intermediary. There is still, his voice is still present within the play. It's just filtered through, it's still filtered through other characters, but it's, you know, Di is, although she's not directly questioning, I guess the thing, like at the start of the play, her mind is already made up that Jack is innocent. And then obviously that just gets deconstructed as it goes. And most of that deconstruction is actually done through words that Jack has sent through one medium or another. So
I think Jack's like a really good example. And again, it's another reason why I think he's kept off stage, in the sense that I think in a lot of ways he becomes a symbolic representation of a like a microcosm, I guess, of like sort of toxic masculine teenage boy behavior, which, you know, you can view in many ways as both. I think it's one of these things where like I always have a saying of like certain things explain but they don't excuse, is like kind of like how I see a lot of these things. And I think one thing that's really something that's really set up around Jack is like he is very much a product of that environment, and that explains, but it then doesn't excuse what he then goes on and does, and his inability to question that, and so on. And I think that's where then it also ties in really nicely with all the stuff going on with Di and the parents, because it then becomes, well, to what extent then is it the parents' job to constantly be on top of their children and making sure that like they're constantly questioning everything they're learning in their society, you know? Like, it's basically like, I think that's the thing, even when she reads the emails, there's that part of you that goes like, at what point can you police and like enter your child's privacy, especially when they're like that awkward age of 17 and like you don't really know what's going on in their heads and you want to protect them, and especially if they've done something really bad and you want to know what they're doing. I think, yeah, I think all of those things sort of like start but to tie in together, if
that makes sense. You've also got the idea that it's seeped somehow up, and we talked about generational stuff, you know, 5-10 minutes ago, but it's seeped up the generational line to her, to the dad as well, to her husband. And it's kind of like, oh shit, like where does the rot stop, kind of thing, in that, well, I thought, yeah, kids of a certain age might be doing it, and as you say, it's not excusable, but it's, you know, it helps to illuminate the character. But then you get that idea that the dad is also kind of fully immersed in this whole idea of kind of sharing images and whatever goes on kind of within those WhatsApp groups or whatever it might be. And then that puts another slant on the whole kind of acceptability of what's going on.
I think also it equally seeps down as it does seep up. I think that's something that I really got the sense of, and it really made me think of, I think one of the things that's really interesting is he says he shares it because he's proud. I think that's really interesting. It's a really interesting, I think it's quite ballsy of the writer, because I think it's something that we don't really talk about ever, because it's kind of weird.
So I just want to quickly say, is there, in very quickly in response to what you just said, is that seeping downwards? Are we in a moment, and does this play illuminate that, whether it knows it does or not, that the dads who are interacting in that behavior, and again, it's a very difficult way thing to talk about, because I don't want to come across as, again, saying any of it is acceptable. And I'm very much one that, you know, even the wolf whistle from the guys on the work site is, I think it's just crap. And it really impacts females' lives day to day in a way that is just totally unacceptable. But they would have operated in a very localized setup. If you know, they wouldn't have had the technology to share all the image and stuff. They would have had the conversations and they would have whatever. And they don't know that the impact that they're having on their children by continuing the lads thing or whatever suddenly makes it a, you know, pandemic rather than a whatever, because they can send it wherever they want to whoever they want. And the boys, especially, who are, you know, kind of listening to and influenced by the dads in a way where their dads haven't fully appreciated the further impact of what their kids can now do with social media against what they could do just wolf-whistling a girl who walked past them or whatever it might be, and having literally in the four people in that group for that moment shared that, yeah, boys, yeah, look at her, isn't she hot? It never went any further. But nowadays they can they can take the photo of the girl as she walks past, or take the photo up her skirt as she walks past and send that off and say, all right, lads, look at this. And then 50,000 people have seen it. So like, it's weird how maybe that crossover is occurring where.
I think there is a risk though, that you start then using the tech as an excuse. Whereas I think the tech has just revealed something that was already there rather than is to blame for any of this happening. And I think,
but doesn't it make it more impactful on the females who are having to suffer it?
It has different impacts, but I think ultimately it comes from the same place.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I was going to say, I think like the same nervousness or even, I guess, paranoia can be seen in the play. So like Di very early on starts asking David about the photos that they took when they were younger. And I think he says, oh, no, I didn't share them. But like by the end of the play, you don't know whether to believe that or not. So there's, I think like what Matt was just saying, like the tech doesn't make it happen. It just makes perhaps wider sharing more
possible. I agree with that. I think that's that's what I'm kind of alluding to. I'm trying to say, like, if it's more localized, the impact might be shallower. But when it becomes you know, the ability to spread it far and wide, you get it not just out of a village or a town, you know, someone across the world can send you a Facebook message that says, oh, I saw you in that sex video, blah, blah, blah. It's like, what the hell's that? You then can't escape it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like it's like fundamentally what it does is the tech highlights how systemic the actual attitude is in terms of, you know, like it's one of those things where I think people can very easily go, oh, it's just a wolf whistle. You know, like, what's that really doing? Like, kind of thing, like, oh, it's a bit annoying and like whatever. But the thing is, like, it's the very culture with which people think they can behave like that to someone else that then can escalate and amplify and then become the thing that then we go, oh, you know, but we would never do that. Like, I think it's, you know, it points out the ways in which these things, like I say, like, they trickle down, but they all come from the same place and attitude towards others.
I guess, feeding directly off that then, and this is, you have answered this, but maybe I want to push you all on a kind of a more direct response. What was the actual impact of coming to the end of it? What were you left with? What was the residue of the play in your minds? And I know, Kelly, you've gone slightly deeper maybe than Cheryl or Matt, but what was kind of like the residing thought having left the book on the side once you finished reading it? God. Was it fear? Were you just worried?
No, it's nothing. No, no.
No, okay. No.
I'm undecided as to whether the play is to be lauded for having for like generating these kinds of conversations or criticized for like for me for having two quite big gaps, which are it doesn't really represent in any detail how those kinds of worldviews come to be, like what the masculine environment is like. And as someone, you know, who went to, you know, secondary school in these kinds of environments, to me there's so much to explore there that could be put on display that I think would be quite fresh and new for lots of people. But he doesn't do that. And then the other side of it is the actual impact on Cara, which we see very little of. And as we say at the end, like it's very unsatisfying because we don't know these impacts will go on for years and could affect all sorts of things, jobs, you know, future relationships, you know, her entire life essentially. But we don't see any of that either. So those are the two things you really need to see to understand this. And we don't see either of them. But maybe the play is just a starting point from which people then come and talk about these things. But
I think though that the minimal access that we have to Cara is what makes the play so believable. The fact that actually, I mean, Di starts to care about the impact it's had on Cara by the end, but like the focus of the of all the other characters in the play is on Jack, even from Cara's family side. You know, they seemingly don't sort of actually talk to Cara or ask her how she's feeling or what she wants to happen. Their pure motive is like, our daughter, our sister has been hurt by this guy, so let's make this guy suffer. And not actually that there's it doesn't seem like anyone other than Di eventually, and Di, you know, obviously it's still quite minimal. That's the only time that anyone actually asks Cara if she's okay or what's going on with her. So I felt like actually the complete lack of anyone really paying any attention, and certainly at the end the fact that we don't know what's happened to Cara and she's you know, she's not even mentioned, I thought that was actually one of the most believable parts of the play.
That speech, that last scene, is my favorite scene in the play. And that bit when she says, are you okay? I always remember it in the play because the girl who played Cara played her like tough as nails, like the whole way through it. Like she was pretty, like pretty strong willed. Like, when she says, like, are you okay? Like, has anyone asked you that? It's the only moment where you see her get like have a flash of vulnerableness.
How is that kind of, it's a weird thing I find in some plays where one character seems to be a lot more aware, like mature, educated, I don't know, like has this deeper understanding of the nuances of what activities people are doing. And you sometimes think, how is she so smart in this situation? And she does, and you can please disagree with me, but it does feel like she has this kind of like, apathy is not the word, but like a, yeah, of course this has happened and it will happen again and whatever, whatever. But it feels like a greater knowledge and understanding than maybe someone of her years should have. Am I incorrect in thinking that?
I think yes and no, because in one hand, I do get what you mean. But at the same time, I think one of the reasons why it works to be her is because she's the person it's happened to. And I don't think anyone else could have that speech of knowing the experience of it. Like, I think that's part of it. You know, one of it's, you know, like, you know,
but she doesn't know the fallout from it. She doesn't know. I mean, she doesn't implicitly know that it will continue to reverberate within her being. I know she can know that, but the way she articulates it feels like there's a lot more knowing than.
Yeah, kind of, in the sense that, well, you know, like, well, her line is like, you know, you don't think about the fact that, like, every time the song plays that was playing on the radio when he did it, I feel like I'm going to throw up. So I think there's definitely like. Yeah, like I kind of got what you mean, but I think at the same time, one of the big parts of Kara, at least I remember thinking when I watched it, is you get a really strong sense in the first scene of what Di and David think of sort of Kara and Thick Nick, as they call him, the best friend. And one of the big things is that there's just an immediate assumption of them not being very bright and not being very with it and not really understanding the world kind of thing. And I think that's one of the things I find really enjoyable about the play, because even Thick Nick, who doesn't really say anything super profound or anything, is much more you know, he's not what they think he is, as it turns out.
She's also just she's just aware of the world she's living in, you know, like the apathy I don't think is misplaced. Like she knows the family that she comes from, she knows what the local opinion is of her family, she knows that loads of people have seen the video and have formed their own judgments by the way they're treating her, and like she knows the police are very unlikely to listen to her family. And I mean, you know, if you look more broadly as well, like the stats on kind of like justice anyway are really low. So I think she's just like, I didn't find her apathy surprising. Like she didn't seem like, I don't know, it all made sense to me what she was saying. Like
okay.
It's like it's you know, I could drag myself through this process where I could go down this route or that route, but like to what end? I'm just gonna, everyone already has decided what they, you know, what they think of me, and I don't, you know, I don't think that's gonna change by going down this route that will probably lead to nowhere. Yeah, so I don't know, it felt quite believable what she was saying. It didn't feel like an unlikely speech, if that makes sense.
Okay,
I think I'm gonna say something slightly chip on shouldery here, but I think The perceptions of them, of sort of Kara at the beginning by Di and David, come from a place of thinking, sort of not consciously, but just unconsciously, what is intelligence? And to them, it's their son going to Durham. And that's the marker of intelligence. So it's like, in a way, I think, I don't want to accuse all middle-class people, but, you know, sort of, in a way, what middle-class people do is they colonize success because they say, okay, these are the successful things. This is what makes you look successful. Oh, it just so happens, you know, that's all the things that we do. So if you don't do them, then, you know, screw you. You're a failure. We can forget about you. And we'll probably come to all sorts of judgments about you. So I think that's the deeper question, really, is about different kinds of intelligence and the fact that for some reason we have elevated academic intelligence to some unholy level and then demoted everything else, when, you know, anyone who has interacted with sort of clever people at work realizes it's kind of the value of social intelligence, for example, and other forms of intelligence as well. And that's what you get with Thick Nick, is a bit more of a kind of emotional intelligence, actually, which almost everyone else in the play seems to lack as well. So that's what I think sort of about the perception issue. It's to do with that.
Okay. Nice. Can we quickly jump into kind of like, and we have, we by virtue of just our conversation kind of going all over the place, we've talked about bits of this, but in terms of the structure of the play and the story arc, what were our kind of feelings on the way he wrote it? Did you find it conventional reading it off the page?
Yeah, and I think it worked well in terms of telling the story and making it believable, because the audience were kind of following the path along with Di. Like, whether or not she was intended to be the central character, I think she did work in that function, like kind of guiding you through, and at least whatever your overall impressions of each character were, you were finding out the information at the same time as that character. So you had kind of, yeah, someone to follow through. So the plot kept being surprising, but not in a confusing way. Like, it was kind of like, here's a new revelation, here's a new one, and helped you to stitch it all together. So yeah, I thought the structure was good and followed the process.
Do you reckon it would have been different had Di not kind of naturally fallen into the narrator? She wasn't the narrator, but following her kind of path through the story.
If you follow David, then yeah, you'd have come up with a totally different outcome by the end, or it would have all just kind of, I don't know, disappeared into nothing. Or if you'd followed, like Matt was saying, if the play had actually followed Cara's trajectory, then yeah, you'd have got a different, it would have had to go to a different place as well. So
why does Di become, why is she the best choice to be the vehicle?
I think because she goes through, I think more than David, she goes through such a massive arc herself. Like, she goes from thinking like her son is, you know, that like an angel on earth, to having to, you know, kind of reassess that, and also kind of think about, you know, her role as a mother, and then also just, you know, work out what's going on with her husband, and like, you know, he's and like reassess that. Sorry, I should phrase that better.
No, I loved it because it's so true.
Yeah, basically, like, the two people she lives with, she read by the end of the play, she doesn't feel like she knows either of them, and so I feel like she's a good vehicle, because you're seeing so many different angles and different versions of the story through her lens as she tries to work out which one's true. And then by the end of it, like, the play doesn't sort of say what happens between her and David, but like, I can't see the marriage like lasting, really. Like, so yeah, that's why I think it works well, that she has such an emotional kind of journey, whereas I don't think David really does. He's just trying to kind of save his own skin, really, throughout most of it, and obviously look after Jack as well, whereas she has the soul searching part of it, I guess.
Have you got Matt, just following up.
Just going to say, doesn't it mean though that she has to be remarkably naive, because basically everything comes as a surprise to her? And like, okay, she knew about the pictures from her husband. She knew that already, but somehow had maybe suppressed that or not interrogated it further. But she didn't suspect any of this. I mean, is that? I just felt like everything she got to, she's like, oh, I had no idea about this. This is completely new. And then moves on to the next thing. And that's, you know, as an audience member, that's what your experience is, because you haven't seen the play before. So she kind of has to do that in a way that maybe is a little bit hard to get on board with. Maybe. I think it works generally, but I just wonder whether she's a bit too naive at times.
I don't think she's naive. I think she's prejudiced. I think that's another reason why I find her arc really important, because I think she fundamentally has really bad views of how the world works, and like, that because of our own class ideas, mixed with also just, I think, a very human blindness to the thought that your children will be, you know, that you think highly of your children, kind of thing, and like to think yourself as a good parent. And I think she's a real combination of the two. And then also, I think there's something really interesting with David, and the fact that she says quite early on that one of the reasons why she loves him is because he's not like a hard man, violent thing going on. But then you kind of get the sense that that's like a bit of a like psychological thing going on with him in himself, and not knowing quite, you know, I guess maybe like who he is and how to manifest like his sense of masculinity. I don't know. And then I think, and then there's that really good line where she says, "I used to always be able to tell when you were lying." And it's this sense of sort of someone changing in front of you and you don't even realize. And suddenly one day you wake up and
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She says, I think early in the play, she's like, oh, I can always tell when you're lying. So yeah, I think naivety is like a fair point, but I think it's definitely like more of actually like coming from almost like a place of prejudice that needs to be like unlearned, as well as also just, I think, a very human sense of wanting to always believe your children and your partner are the people you think they are, I guess. I think, I think we'd always like to think that we know those people who are closest to us.
is the arc, let me rephrase that. What is the change in her character then? As you've just said, Kelly is presented as there is this, well, she's allowing prejudice to seep into her thoughts and decision-making and assessment of situations. Are we saying by the end of it that the writer has turned her around, or is she not changed, or is she, because there is that kind of,
I mean, she's not perfect by the end of the play, but she's, you know, a bit,
well, she hasn't phoned the police, and she hasn't done much about it other than make sure her son gets off the union.
Exactly.
Yep.
But she's had a wake-up call of sorts. So it doesn't fix her character, and there's still lots of things she could do that would be, you know, in terms of like a satisfactory ending, would be much more convenient. But she has an awakening that, yeah, she's not living the picture perfect life that she thought she was, and that, yeah, things are, yeah, she can't keep her, I guess she can't kind of keep her head in the sand about kind of, you know, who her son is, who her husband is, and
how the impact they're having in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And that she's having as well, kind of complicitly, yeah.
I was going to say, isn't something really, really sinister in her sending her son away to uni, knowing that he's raped a girl, and then having no oversight over his behaviour when he's there?
I mean, I agree, but I guess the question is, how do you? I mean, I rationalise that in my head, in that they'd sat him down, had a chat with him, and said, "Look, mate, this is the shit we've been through with you. This is what's happened. Off to uni you go, but you be a good boy, all right? Don't you do anything silly."
It's super clear that she, and I mean, and again, this is very human, but it's very clear that she has no idea how to actually deal with it, because her one of the, like, you know, halfway through or three quarters of the way through, she said, you know, her offer to Kara is, oh, okay, I'll just give your family 20 minutes to like do what they
want. Beat the crap out of him.
Yeah, exactly. And then that'll give us some closure and we can all just move on. Like, so she definitely has no idea kind of what to do with it, which again is fairly human, but that again, that's the point at which, you know, you might expect her to do something other than, yeah, sending him off to Durham.
The desire to close the book on it is really important to her, because that allows, it's like a freedom then, to be tethered to it forevermore is, yeah.
And I think it fundamentally taps into, like, what would you do for your kid? Which I think, I guess, is that question, like you said, that he asked his mum that made him write the play. I don't think, even though she does have an arc, I definitely don't think there's a resolution. I think it's an arc of sort of realizing also that not only that people around her aren't who she thought they were in terms of her son and her husband, but also like how she perceived Kara and Nick and her own background and the way in which like they came out of that kind of thing, like that superior sense of superiority kind of thing going on, I think gets completely dismantled in her brain. Not that she has anything to do about it afterwards, but I think that does happen.
Okay. That's that. I mean, but I guess the last thing, which is maybe a more technical one, not so technical that I don't think you guys can broach it as a question, but I kind of want to get your very quick thoughts on the way it's written. I don't know if there's anything that anyone particularly noted about the way it was written, or whether they felt it was kind of just, it was quite realistic and it was quite, you know, as you say, naturalistic right at the start. But
I did find like the, and I think you've already mentioned this, Kelly, but the lack, I know this isn't about the dialogue specifically, but the lack of stage directions and the lack of kind of setting confusing at first. I think I kind of got into it a bit more, and there were a couple of scenes where you did know kind of where they were, particularly like the pub scenes. But yeah, that was quite interesting. You know, you just got the asterisks on the page and then you're like, okay, so are we, is it the next day? Is it, are we somewhere else? Are we still in the house? Where are we? And I think, yeah, I can imagine that. Obviously, you know, if you see it on stage, obviously, then that becomes very clear to you because you can get kind of some indication of the passing of time or change of location. So I think probably, yeah, it works well for a director because you can choose how long you want that development and that kind of all those interactions to take place over. You know, do you want Jack to be away for a week, a month? How long do you want him to be away for? But that, I found it quite jarring at first, not having any context in which to
come. Yeah, I think just as reference or context for those who may not have read other plays, normally you might get a scene delineation and a note of environment, time, or other things that might be going on, just let alone bits that are actually directional, just in terms of setting up where we're at and what's going on is, I would say, maybe, in a lot of recent plays I've read, maybe not the norm anymore, but it used to be the norm to have that. Was it, Matt, was it, I don't know, anything particular that stood out to you, or did you find it quite...
Well, you know, as someone who's tried to write plays, I think it read so naturalistically that I wanted to read it out loud. I really, yeah, like really wanted to read it out loud. I could barely keep myself just reading it in my own head. So I think that was very well done. And with these things, it's always very tricky to get the balance of like empty language that is just, you know, very short sentences that we use all the time in normal speech. So managing that while keeping the story going is, you know, a really tricky thing to do and something that was done really well.
How did you find it tonally in terms of getting the actual dialogue for the individuals on point?
Yeah, I felt they all had distinctive voices, but again, the kind of ambiguity around David, I couldn't quite place him culturally. Maybe it's because he is kind of ambiguous and middle ground and not particularly distinctive. But I mean, the thing is, plays always end up being a bit absurd because there aren't that many people you meet in life who are so remarkable that they could, you know, hold up a play on their own. So plays are always a bit kind of overdone in that sense. They have to be. But I felt they were
all... And something has to happen, right? Something has to happen in a dramatic way. So,
yeah, exactly. In terms of kind of the structure and not really having one or having a very loose one or, you know, not being clear what follows what, I felt that kind of helped the claustrophobic nature of it because it didn't matter really what was happening. You just were back in their heads trying to figure out what was going on. You were back in Di's dilemma of just seeing all these sort of contradictory messages. So I think that helped in a sense. If it would have been, you know, oh, we're jumping to this other place where you don't have to think about that stuff anymore, then you as a viewer would have gone, oh, okay, I can relax a bit. But you never get that. You just constantly kind of with her trying to figure out what's going on. So I think that structure helped to tell the story in that way.
Cool. All right, good. Perfect. Well, before I do let you go, I'll start with you, Matt, because I'm hoping you have done some homework. What would you recommend as a piece of theatre to read off the page? He didn't do the homework. Look at his face. He's like, oh, we were meant to do this, were we?
I can think of a play. We're just trying to think what I read recently. So I quite like James Graham's Albert Einstein, which is a two-hander between Albert Einstein and the guy who lives with him. So that would be mine.
It's just that you gave it to me.
Yeah, did I? Okay, maybe see. There you go. Recommended.
Recommended and given. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, never want to see it again.
Why? Just out of interest? What was your...
I mean, I think James Graham does this quite a lot, but taking someone who's sort of infamous and then making them a real life character is a very tricky thing to do. So, and also a two-hander, trying like maintaining that over the course of a play, you know, it's just extremely difficult and... He manages to do it very well.
Okay. Good. Taken, noted. First one in the bank of recommendations. Look at that. He's just gone down in history. Well done. Cheryl?
So do you want only contemporary plays? Because obviously
anything you want. Anything I know, but you know.
Post-1600, I do.
I can do post-1600 as long as you don't want post-1700. Like... I'm happy with contemporary. I just, you know, there are some very good 17th century plays out there.
Are there?
Yeah, generally a lot funnier than Shakespeare as well.
You give me whatever you want.
All right, good.
If I'm not happy, I'll invite you back and you have to give another one.
Okay, cool. Well, I would probably Yeah, Volpone. I know I've told you to read it before. I've told all of you to read it before, but it's so funny.
You've literally printed it out for me and given it to me.
I did.
In person.
And he still hasn't read it.
But it's really funny.
It's quite long though, isn't it?
I mean, it's certainly longer than this one, yeah. I'm going to say it's about three times as long, but I'll find a contemporary one for next time to recommend.
What does that? So for those who might, but who might want to read it, what would be the...
It's a city comedy satire written in the early 1600s anyway. And it's about a chap called Volpone. His name translates as the fox. And he's a very wealthy gentleman who pretends that he's dying to see people fawning over him so that they can be written into his will. And basically the play just satires all these different characters within the city who are trying to get money from him, who are kind of bringing him gifts, but he's also like a complete jerk. There's a lot of redeeming
characters in there.
They're all awful. Like, the play, hating absolutely everybody on stage, but it's really, really funny. And the RSC did a production with Henry Goodman playing Volpone a few years, maybe 2016. And yeah, like, just a very, very funny play. That's why I would recommend it. Awful people, but well.
Kelly.
Another not so funny one, maybe. Should I recommend a comedy? Should I like try and make sure my tastes don't seem like I just like really like intense depressing stuff? But no, I'll recommend it. It's called Linda. It's by Penelope Skinner. Yeah. I love that play. I think it's really interesting. I think it's got a really great speech at the very beginning that is extremely relatable as anyone who is ever been a female actress. It's literally a speech where she complains that there's no good female speeches in like modern stuff, and you have to like try and find stuff and like cobble stuff together. And what's great is it's a massive long speech, so it's basically Penelope Skinner going, here you go, here's one, I'm gonna write one for you all, where you can all just rant at the audition panel. So yeah, but no, it's a really good, it's a really good play, so yeah, that's probably my recommendation.
All right, cool. I am very quickly going to recommend The Lion in Winter by James Goldman. I don't know if any of you have read it. I basically... weirdly, so it was the first play, I think one of the first plays I ever read. And I was like, this is amazing. I love theatre so much. This thing is just so amazing. I got to watch it. And obviously, I found out it was a film. I watched a film. I really love the film. But since that moment until now, anyone who's like a theatre person has always said, ah, shit. What are you talking about? That's like such a terrible play. What? It's so badly written. There's no real, and I'm like, oh, have I missed the point here? Have I missed the whole, like, am I that guy that doesn't really understand theatre? And I love the play that all the theatre people hate. So read it, guys. You might love it.